Our next panel, the panelists are here, so we're ready to go. It's a serious topic, domestic violence. It's not just physical. And we've got Sherry Roessler, Executive Director, Society for the Blind, Sacramento, California. And we've got Beth Hassett, CEO, Weave, Sacramento, California. So when we hear the words domestic violence, we often automatically think physical abuse. There are other types beyond physical, and this presentation will cover the less talked about types of domestic violence and how people who are blind or have low vision are affected. It will also explore how to find resources and when and how to report suspicious abuse. All right, so we'll turn it over to our panelists, Sherry and Beth, and go from there.
You're muted, Sherry.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for inviting Beth and me to present to you this morning. It's an honor to be with all of you, and hope your conference has been great so far. Beth and I are going to tag team this presentation today, going through, as was mentioned in our introduction, different forms of violence, how to identify that, how to seek help, and then we're also going to talk about the partnership that Weave and Society for the Blind have been engaged in now for, I think, going on 3 years. And so that hopefully at the end of this presentation, all of you will have sort of some of the most recent information that's out there, as well as to know about the resources available if you or someone you love is experiencing domestic violence or sexual assault. And so with that, I am going to turn it over to Beth Hassett to walk us through impact of domestic violence and some of the definitions.
Hi, thank you for having me. Just a little bit about Weave. We are an agency in the Sacramento region providing services and supports for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and sex trafficking. And wherever you are in California, there is one of our sister agencies that can provide similar supports in your area. And I just want you all to know that. So I'm going to talk about what Weave does, but there is a whole network of rape crisis centers and domestic violence agencies throughout the state that all offer similar services, although they don't have the partnership that we have with Society for the Blind, which I think makes us a bit unique. So I thought we'd start by defining what domestic violence and sexual assault are. So what is domestic violence? As was previously mentioned, most people think of it as just being physical abuse. And I think you need to click, Sherry. One thing that's important to note is when we're talking about domestic violence, we're talking about something between intimate partners, so people in a relationship, or ex-partners, or people who are co-parenting a child together. So we're not talking about a parent and their adult child, which might be elder abuse, which is something we do address, but there's a different dynamic with domestic violence when it's roommates or a neighbor or, you know, some other type of violence. So we're talking about people who are or were in some kind of an intimate relationship. And it's a pattern of behavior, of controlling behavior. So we're not talking about like a couple that got in a fight one time or occasionally is volatile with each other. There's a lot of unhealthy relationship activity that is both partners equally participating in co-battering each other. But in domestic violence, we're talking about one abusive partner who wants power and control in the relationship over the other partner. So think about that. It's using whatever tactics are available to inflict power and control over another person. So that's just kind of a baseline of what we're talking about here. So when we talk about domestic violence, we're really talking about six different forms of abuse. So of course, there's the physical, which we already talked about, and that most people think of. But then we've got these other five types of abuse that I'm going to delve a little more deeply into. There's emotional. We also have sexual, financial, spiritual, and then a new one. We really, our field just added this one in the past couple of years, technological. And so I'll run through each of these so that you know what we're talking about, because ultimately our goal is that you would be able to identify domestic violence if you see it in your own relationship, but also in coworkers, friends, family, your neighbors, and be able to respond in an empathetic and kind way and refer that person to the appropriate resources in your community. So let's talk about physical. A lot of people just think of somebody being punched or hit. Well, I can tell you that the majority of the survivors that we work with were never punched or hit. There might have been some other type of physical abuse, but generally that's not their experience. So I think that's confusing for a lot of survivors and victims, because unless they were punched or hit, they think whatever they're experiencing doesn't count as domestic violence. So part of the importance of the rest of us understanding what it looks like is validating the experience that somebody's having and assuring them that if they're feeling under somebody's power and control, or are feeling uncomfortable and unsafe in their relationship, that counts. It counts as domestic violence. So we've got throwing things or destroying property. That's physical violence, even though it might not be directed at the person. Holding someone down, putting someone in a dangerous situation. If somebody's blind or has low vision, you know, leaving them somewhere where they don't have access to, you know, even knowing where they are or getting home, withholding medication or food. So if somebody's a caretaker for somebody, you know, hiding medication or not going to pick up a prescription. Of course, shoving, pushing, grabbing, slapping, shaking, all of those physical things. Threatening somebody with a weapon, whether they use it or not, just knowing that there's a gun in the house can be very frightening for somebody who's on the victim side of things. And strangulation, which is really taking on new importance in looking at domestic violence. It's one of the number one indicators that somebody will eventually kill their partner if they've ever strangled somebody, has ever tried to stop the breath of somebody. And a lot of victims call this choking. It's not choking. Choking is when your food goes down the wrong pipe. Strangulation is putting hands on somebody's neck and actually strangling them. So those are all the different kinds of physical abuse that we look for. Emotional, 100% of victims have experienced some sort of emotional abuse. That's just a number one tactic by a perpetrator. And that could include put downs and name calling, anything that makes somebody's self-esteem suffer. Using prejudicial words about people with vision loss, you know, again, name calling, but also, you know, diminishing your personhood because of a disability. Threatening to hurt themselves or you if you leave. A lot of times it's, I'll kill myself if you leave. I can't live without you. And that often makes it really challenging for somebody to choose to leave an abusive relationship. Blaming and shaming, isolating from friends, family, and social activities. And we've seen that just times 100 during the pandemic. You know, we're forced into isolation. And so that makes it extra hard for somebody who already is being isolated by their partner. Crazy making and gaslighting. This sounds like a strange type of emotional abuse, but I mean, we've seen survivors where the partner goes in and moves things. And if somebody, you know, in the house and then claims they didn't. And so if somebody is blind or has low vision, you know, having a table moved 4 feet over or chairs moved around and then saying, I didn't move anything, it's always been there, is part of the dynamic of saying, you know what, you can report me, but they'll just say you're crazy, you know, because you're crazy. So we see that often as a tactic, any kind of humiliation, and then stalking. So that often happens with, you know, ex-partners where the abusive partner is stalking them, sitting outside their house, trying to reach them through their friends, that kind of a thing. Sexual abuse is any kind of rape or other form of sexual assault. Believe it or not, until just recently, spousal rape wasn't a thing. The courts did not identify that if a married person was sexually assaulted by their partner, that that was any kind of a crime, which is just kind of crazy to me. Coercion or pressuring somebody into having sex, forced pregnancy or forced abortion. So, you know, withholding contraceptives, that kind of a thing. Unwanted pornography, forcing a partner to participate in using pornography, threatening to cheat or actually cheating is another form of sexual abuse. Demanding or sending sexual pictures of the victim, and really any unwanted sexual activity all falls under sexual. So believe it or not, about 90% of the people we work with have some form of financial abuse in their history. So that can look like denying access to money or financial accounts or passwords, getting somebody fired, forcing them to lose their job or lose their housing, putting somebody on an allowance and saying, you know, you have to cook me a meal every night and I'm only going to give you $20 a week. So you have to make that work. And then being angry when the person doesn't do that, ruining their credit. We see that a lot. Coercing somebody into signing documents they don't really understand what they are, and suddenly they've bought a car that they've never seen. Destroying their property, excessive spending, so spending all the money, harassing them at work to the point that they lose their jobs, which happens a lot, forcing someone to work or forbidding them to work, and constant monitoring of their spending. So it can take years for somebody to dig themselves out of the financial abuse that they experienced by their partner. And finally, first, spiritual abuse, not allowing somebody to practice their religion, go to church or whatever that looks like for them, or mocking their religion or the culture that they came from, if they're from a different culture, forcing someone to do things that are against their beliefs, their spiritual beliefs, or even just your values, that you know, the things that you hold dear to you. Not allowing you to better yourself through education, making it really hard for somebody to go to school. We see that many a time, especially in dating relationships with college students, where during finals week, not allowing the person to study, using religion to justify abuse. We see that often with very patriarchal religions, very fundamentalist religions that use scripture to justify the abuse, to treat somebody like they're their property, not allowing hobbies, making all the household decisions and not allowing the victim to do so, and not giving somebody time for their own self-care. You know, maybe they're constantly working full-time, having to tend to the children and being on edge all the time because they don't know what their abusive partner is going to do. And now finally, technological abuse. So that can be GPS tracking through a phone or by something put into a vehicle, withholding, hiding, destroying, or removing batteries from assistive devices or tech items. Something very, you know, specific to somebody who is blind or has low vision there. Cyber stalking through social media. Maybe the partners have broken up, but creating fake Facebook accounts and trying to friend the person to keep an eye on what they're up to. Controlling passwords, constantly texting or calling. That is a very common tactic, especially when the relationship is devolving and they're really losing control of the person that they've been abusing. Controlling social media accounts or making threats to use social media. Maybe there are naked pictures and, you know, threatening that they're going to put those on social media, or or do something to embarrass their partner, spreading rumors on social media, and or cutting off or limiting any electronic communication, you know, taking phones. We had a bill that that passed in the legislature a few years ago where victims could get separated from a family cell phone account, because what we see often is the abusive partner, you know, suspending service or, you know, cutting off their phone. And as we all know these days, your phone can be your lifeline to, you know, getting information or reaching out for help to somebody. I mean, I don't know anybody's phone numbers anymore. If my phone were gone, I wouldn't know how to reach anybody. So those are the types of abuse that we're talking about. And I want to touch on sexual assault. So sexual assault is any type of sexual contact or behavior that occurs without the explicit consent of the recipient. And this is really important. Up until a few years ago, if somebody didn't say no, then they often could use that in a court case. Well, she didn't say no, so, you know, she thought she was all on board because they'd already been making out and seemed like everything was going great. And that changed recently. And now they have to prove that the person actually said yes and consented, and consented to every part of the sexual encounter. So anybody who's ever been in a sexual situation knows, you know, you might kiss and you might go to the next step, and, you know, and then you get to a point where you're like, yeah, I don't want to do that. And so they really have to have consented all the way along for it to be a consensual sexual act. It can include forced sexual intercourse, which is what we think of as rape, or sodomy. Sexual assault includes child molestation, incest, fondling, any sexual act that somebody didn't consent to, and even attempted rape, even if the rape didn't actually happen. And I think the thing that often is confusing for people is a perpetrator, most often we find, isn't a stranger. I think we picture somebody jumping out of a bush and raping somebody, and that is very, very seldom the case. It is most often an acquaintance or a family member or a spouse or partner or ex-partner or somebody in authority, a teacher, a person at church who might have some power over the person, or it could be a stranger. And the important thing to really think about here is the dynamic that somebody is experiencing when the perpetrator is somebody that they trusted, that knows their friends and family, that is part of their circle of friends and acquaintances. That can be a huge barrier for reporting a sexual assault in a timely fashion or ever. And I say timely fashion because unless it's reported while there's still evidence on the person's body and law enforcement can be called and we can do an evidentiary exam, all that evidence goes away and it makes it much harder for anybody to prosecute and investigate what happened and for there to be any closure for the victim. And if the person's a person of authority, they may be afraid to report because of the repercussions that will happen, or really a fear that they're not going to be believed by anybody, that, you know, why would this person who is of great stature in our community or that we all respect, why would they do that kind of a thing? And with a stranger, it can be really, really difficult to report, because especially if somebody is blind or has low vision, because, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, just because law enforcement often is not, doesn't believe that the person can be a good witness to the crime because they can't see. And we know that that's not true. So that's sexual assault. And here is just a list of the impact and what you might see if somebody has experienced domestic violence or sexual assault. They may be absent from work or school. If there are physical injuries from domestic violence, you know, people might not show up if they've got a black eye, that kind of a thing. Or they might have anxiety or depression, which also can result in absences. There can be a lot of self-blame. What did I, you know, it's my fault. In a domestic violence relationship, the perpetrator is very often blaming the victim. You know, you made me do this. If you would only do X, Y, and Z, then I wouldn't have to treat you this way. With sexual assault, it's why did I get drunk? Why did I go over to that person's house? You know, none of those things are legitimate, but that can be what the survivor is experiencing. Difficulty concentrating, that can either be from that depression and blame and anxiety, but also if somebody's experienced any kind of a head injury or the trauma and that fight and flight reflex that somebody has when they're feeling like they're in grave danger, that can really rattle people's brains and give them kind of a PTSD. Fear, domestic violence victims often are in a constant state of fear for their safety. Social isolation and not wanting to reach out to friends and family is another impact and sign. And, you know, we do a lot of presentations at workplaces because we see each other and know each other and talk to each other every day when it's not COVID and we're not working from home. And very often it's coworkers and supervisors who are noticing some of these changes. So eating, sleeping disturbances, unhealthy coping strategies, maybe somebody who never used alcohol or drugs is suddenly using it a lot. Maybe somebody who was never promiscuous suddenly is on dating apps. And all of these kinds of changes in somebody are things that we look for in identifying whether somebody might be suffering from and experiencing domestic violence or has been sexually assaulted. And I'm going to hand it over to Sherry to talk about gaps in services for survivors who are blind or have low vision.
Great. Thank you, Beth. And for those of you in the convention who may not be familiar with Society for the Blind, we are headquartered in Sacramento, California, and we provide blindness skills training. We have a low vision clinic, a retail store on site, and numerous other support groups. And we serve 27 counties in Northern California. So we're able to provide services to about 5,000 individuals who are blind or have low vision each year. So this partnership with Weave is really important to us, and it has it's really coming together. And so we're really glad that we're able to share some of our wisdom today with all of you. One of the things that we know and we're finding is that just finding statistics and information on survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault who are blind or low vision is nearly impossible. And that's because data that's collected lumps all of the information into one category called persons with a disability. So again, it's challenging to know. What we are able to ascertain from the data is that people who have a disability are 2.5 times more likely to be assaulted. And sadly, women with a disability are 7 times more likely to be victimized. And in the majority of cases, it is the intimate partners and caregivers who are the perpetrators. And I can say in just the past couple of years, we've had some of our students come in, and it is in fact their spouses or their caregivers who are abusing them and have reported to us so we could get them connected with Weave. It is also more challenging to escape or leave an abusive partner. And so again, it makes it doubly hard to get out of there and get help. And as one survivor said in this quote, that it's difficult to ask for help because I don't know if the person helping me is also my attacker. And so again, we see some of the specific challenges folks face. One of the things that we know is that a lot of shelters and offices agencies like Beth represents are not accessible. Some of it is that the physical space is not accessible. They don't have a floor map that's brailled or even large print. Beth and I were at a national conference in Minneapolis, and we toured an agency, and there was no way on earth. It was hard enough for us to find our way around, and there was absolutely zero accessibility by way of wayfinding. Another is assistive technology. Most agencies serving folks who are victims of domestic violence or sexual assault maybe don't even know assistive technologies are out there, Braille note takers, JAWS, Zoom text, you name it. And so there's no way of providing some of the information in accessible formats. And then there's also just the attitudinal access, lack of understanding of how to interact with somebody who's blind or low vision creates a barrier in and of itself for survivors. We also have found that, you know, the ability to have training is challenging. And with the ability, with not having that training, sometimes the interactions are not very respectful. You know, folks who are blind or low vision are treated in the third person as if they're not even there rather than speaking directly to them. There's just a lack of fundamentals and familiarity. And again, as we mentioned, the ability to have accessible devices so that the survivor is able to be a full participant in meetings and have access to all the pertinent information they may need. And, you know, for a lot of folks, the guidance to survivors of domestic violence or other abuse is to have a what we call a go bag, that you have a bag packed with your, you know, clothing, important papers and the like, and you have it someplace kind of hidden that you could quickly grab and get out of the house. Well, that can be very challenging for somebody with vision loss to, you know, one, hide that bag and know that it's got everything in it, that their perpetrator hasn't found it. And it can also be very difficult and more challenging to leave. And so these are some of the, you know, barriers that we have identified that can make it very, very difficult. And as Beth mentioned, law enforcement also can create a barrier in that they don't presume the survivor is going to be a good witness. And they forget that we have smell, we have touch, we have hearing. We have many different ways that we can provide evidence and information about our perpetrators, even if we aren't able to visually describe that person. And so in that way, we know that many survivors of abuse have had their reports, you know, neglected or not taken seriously. I mentioned at the top of this section of our presentation, there's just a sad lack of research and statistics so that to really raise this up and really get people to take it more seriously and ensure that assistive technologies and other accessibility features in shelters and whatnot are in place. And so that's something that, again, Weave and Society for the Blind are working on together in our partnership. And then finally, it's this lumping together of people into one category instead of looking at the unique needs that somebody with vision loss or blindness might have, somebody who's deaf and hard of hearing, somebody else who may be physically challenged. All of these you know, different challenges need to be given their own attention and focus and then resources put together so that when somebody who is blind or low vision, deaf or hard of hearing experiences domestic violence or sexual assault, the resources, the accessibility, the understanding is there so they get the full scope of resources and support that they need. So we've gone over definitions, we've gone over some of the barriers. So we want to look now at what can we do to help survivors who are blind or have low vision? And so again, I want to turn it over to Beth, who's going to start us off.
So Sherry's talked about some of those barriers, and I think recognizing the unique barriers for somebody who has vision loss to seeking services. There can be a difficulty reporting due to inaccessible forms of communication, and they might be physically less able to defend themselves if they can't see their attacker and see the person who's who's abusing them. There's an inaccessibility of information. You know, we've spent a lot of time working on our website, making sure it's accessible. You know, having the partnership with Society for the Blind has really changed how we present information. How would somebody know that they can get counseling services? And, you know, how would somebody know how to access our shelter unless they even had access to information about calling our support and information line? So there can just be a real lack of information out there. The victims might have a lower self-esteem because their abusive partner has been telling them they're worthless and really eroding that confidence over the years. But also being seen as or being treated like they're not capable. And so they may not have the confidence to leave the relationship that they're in. You know, even the most violent and horrible relationship has some bright moments, or people would not stay in them. And I think that's another difficult thing for people to understand. Leaving an unhealthy relationship or an abusive relationship isn't just one act. It's not like you leave on a Tuesday. It's a process that people go through. And it starts with, is what I'm experiencing even abusive? Does it even really count? And it takes a lot of confidence to finally say, okay, I'm ready to go. And I have faith in myself that I'm going to be able to access the support that I need. Somebody who has additional challenges, somebody who has vision loss, may have a much greater dependence on their partner or caregiver than somebody else, you know, really depending on them for transportation and all of those things that provide access to the world. So that, again, makes it much more difficult to leave. So there's a fear that reporting this abuse might mean losing their source of support and care. And in many, many relationships, their source of funding, their source of income. And we find, you know, many, many people are fearful that if they leave, they're not going to be able to support themselves. And just those basic needs of shelter and food, where are they going to find that? And if there are children in the mix, it can be even more challenging for them because, you know, who's going to take care of my children? Or are the courts going to take the children away from me because they don't perceive I can be an appropriate parent to them and give them to my abusive partner? That's a huge fear. So we have a whole legal department, and that's a lot of what they do is work on dissolution of relationships, of marriages, and also that child custody piece of it. They might not have access to the bank accounts because their partner has all the passwords and all the information. And again, they can't just go. They can't just hop in a car and run away. And, you know, we find that with lots of the survivors we serve. You know, there are many, many reasons that somebody is unable to leave a relationship right away or seek those services that might lead to being able to exit that relationship. So how do you start a conversation with somebody that you perceive might have experienced domestic violence or sexual assault? That's one of the biggest barriers for those of us around people who we perceive might be in an abusive or unhealthy relationship. And unfortunately, the silence actually reinforces the abusive behavior because the victim starts to believe, well, wow, nobody else is reaching out to me and asking if I'm okay. Maybe this is normal. Maybe this is okay. And we unwittingly appear to be supporting the abusive partner. And very often, the abusive partner is a very charming and likable person when they're out in the world. There very often is this Jekyll and Hyde thing that goes on where the family and friends and people around the victim think, oh, so-and-so is a great person, you know, what a fun and funny person. Whereas at home or in private, they're very abusive and can become very volatile and angry. So starting a conversation and being very trauma-informed, understanding that the person might be embarrassed, might not feel comfortable sharing, might not feel confident about the fact that what they've experienced is domestic violence. You know, things like, you know, asking if somebody's okay. If you see a big change in behavior, just, you know, are you okay? You seem more reserved, or you seem different than you were when I first met you. Providing a safe and private space to talk is very important. You know, pulling them aside, you know, asking to go to coffee, making it safe and private for them, and having a really non-judgmental attitude. That's one of the biggest challenges, especially for a sexual assault survivor, is feeling like people believe them. Actually saying the words to somebody who's experienced either type of violence, saying, you know, I believe you. I believe that what you are telling me you've experienced is real and true. encouraging them to get support from an agency like Weave. One thing to note is that state statute requires that anybody who interacts with any of our clients has gone through extensive training. And what it does is it affords us a level of non-disclosure and confidentiality so that we can't be dragged into court and forced to testify against somebody. And that's an important thing for victims to understand, is that if you tell somebody at a rape crisis center or a domestic violence agency intimate things, even things that you fear might make it look like you were neglecting your child, or you know, something that could be used against you in court, we are compelled to not disclose those things. So I think that's important for them to know. Don't tell people what to do. If one more person asks me why somebody doesn't just leave, I may lose my mind, because there are so many barriers to leaving. And what survivors don't need is to be told what to do, because they're being told what to do every day of their lives by an abusive partner. They're being controlled. So making sure they know what their options are, but without a directive, is really important. And providing options and giving them resources. Time and time again, we hear, you know, I was given this card that has information about how I can get services, and we make them tiny. We make tiny little cards, fold up. You know, that's another challenge with people who have vision loss, is we have tiny, tiny little cards, and that's not necessarily the best way to communicate information. But what we find is people hang on to those. You know, it's something you could just slip into your purse or something, and it might be years before they actually reach out for help. But just, you know, knowing that somebody said there is help for you out there can really be the thing that gives somebody strength and confidence in the future to seek help. So some things that you might say: how can I support you? I'm here for you. I'm concerned for your safety. That's often a nice lead in, especially for somebody who's really minimizing what's going on for them, because that's, you'll find that people who are experiencing domestic violence very much minimize how much danger they're in. We do a thing called a lethality assessment with folks, where we ask them a whole list of questions and then they get a score. And sometimes that score is so high that it's like, oh my gosh, I am really, really worried for you. You know, it's questions like, are there guns in the house? Has your partner ever threatened to kill you? Is your partner not the father or mother of your children? All of these things can ping on a danger scale. Let's make a safety plan. That might look like, you know, Sherry talked about the go bag, but if you can't do that, do you at least know where your important documents are if you needed to leave? Who would you call? Where would you go? Let's have a plan in case things escalate, because things can escalate very quickly in that kind of a relationship. Have you heard of Weave, or know what the organization in your community is that can provide that help? But even Weave is a great resource. We hear from people all over the country and all over the world, because we can help you help the survivor find the appropriate resources in their community through our network. Telling them there's help available, saying it's not your fault, whether it's domestic violence or sexual assault, it is never the victim's fault. But again, they might be being told that it's their fault if they'd only change their behavior. Saying, I believe you, and assuring somebody that they're not alone, because that isolation can make somebody feel like they're the only person in the world experiencing this, and that they really are all on their own and there is no help for them out there.
Thank you, Beth. So Shared Vision Sacramento is the name of the partnership that Weave and Society for the Blind have. And this came together, I believe it was 2018, when Weave had an opportunity to apply for a federal grant through the Office of Violence Against Women Act. And the focus of the grant was specifically to create service models for people with disability. And Beth and I have known each other for probably 25 years. So in addition to our friendship and just staying connected over the years, we'd already been working together through a state grant. So they invited Society for the Blind to be their partner on this federal grant. And we were awarded the first round, the 3 years of federal funding for this grant. And surprising to us was that this is the first grant in the nation to a center like Weave that focuses on people who are blind and low vision. And so it's both exciting and it is a lot of work because we're having to educate the folks at the federal level to include blind and low vision in their documents and create a whole new level of awareness and understanding. But it's also, I think, such critical and important work that we're doing together and with Weave as the lead agency, who already has a very, very strong national reputation. So part of this, creating this model, is cross-training our respective staff. We have a Weave counselor that's available at Society for the Blind when we are in open and currently remotely to provide counseling and services for our clients who are reporting if they're in an abusive relationship. As you know, or some of you may know, we have a 24-hour telephone reader service called Access News, and we are also recording information on Access News about Weave and about getting services, because we feel like that is an important and somewhat discreet way for people to be able to get that information. We'll also be creating materials in Braille as well as other accessible formats. We've done an assessment of each other's various facilities, and so together we're able to make some changes, both safety changes, accessibility changes. So we're really excited to get this underway. It's probably moving a little more slowly than Beth and I like to move, but that's the way these federal grants go. But we're really excited, and we're just in the process now of filing for our continuation funding. So I'm going to pause and let Beth add anything else I may have missed.
No, I think, you know, it was really surprising to us that out of 82 grants that they'd had in this program, that we were the only ones addressing blind and low vision. So it's been a great education and a great opportunity to educate the rest of the country about how these services might look unique.
Yeah. So with that, we'll close up our piece of the presentation, and I'll stop my share here, and we'll, I guess, take questions.
Please do. I did hear a hand raised, I think Margie.
Yeah, just a second. I have to get my screen back here.
Absolutely.
All right, Margie. There we go.
I am here. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. First of all, to both of you ladies, thank you so much for a timely and wonderful presentation. And those of you that don't know Sherry, she's an incredible executive director, has brought this agency very much into current times. So thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
I have a question. We're going to talk about the big elephant in the room, and that's the National Center for the Blind Training Centers. We know that there's issues there of sexual assault and other abuse. I am wondering, I know, Sherry, very clearly that you are not an NFB training center, but I think all agencies need to be on high alert. And I'm wondering if you've taken any different types of steps with your staff in light of these allegations. Thank you.
So thank you, Margie. And both Beth and I are aware of the issue that's going on at the national level with the National Center. And, you know, that training is part of and parcel of this model that we're putting together for our staff. And because we understand that, you know, any of our staff could also be survivors of domestic violence or sexual assault. And so, again, that will be incorporated in. And, you know, hopefully we can really start looking at this and helping survivors. And, you know, as Beth talked about in her presentation, that power and control, especially a person who's in a position of authority, it can really, really make it challenging and difficult for somebody to come forward and say that they're experiencing abuse. And so it's sad. Sadly, it's a classic example of what prevents somebody from feeling safe to come forward. Now, Beth, you want to add to that?
Well, and we, you know, so we've been working with Sherry and her staff to train them, and we're honestly willing to train anybody. And we've actually reached out to some of the folks at the national level and have offered to come in and do some awareness training. I mean, I realize that if somebody is the perpetrator and they're getting the training, it's not going to help. But part of our philosophy with both domestic violence and sexual assault is it really takes a village, and it takes all of us paying attention and creating a culture where it's okay to speak your truth and talk about what's going on for you, and that we hold each other accountable. And if an instructor in a Society for the Blind type situation senses that there's something wrong, that there's a culture in that organization that there are going to be consequences for that person. And that really starts at the top. And so, you know, it starts with Sherry, and it starts with talking about it and normalizing the talking about supports for people who've been victimized.
Nellie?
Hi, thank you so much for this really informative presentation. I am a survivor of domestic violence, and I very fortunate in that I had a strong support system, so I had somewhere to go when these experiences occurred. However, I've worked with a number of people who, when faced in this situation, they were turned down at shelters because they were blind or because they had a guide dog and were blind. So my question is, What steps has your organization taken to address the shelters themselves and their understanding of when a person who is blind is in a extreme crisis and needs to leave, and the shelter or the street is the only option? What steps have been taken to help to ameliorate that situation?
Thank you for the question. And thanks to this partnership, our shelters are tricked out. We have so much adaptive equipment. Sherry and her staff have come in and toured even our main service building, everything. We have Braille signage throughout everywhere. We are building 9 permanent supportive housing units. They are all completely adaptive. You know, we really have invested a lot of money and resources into making sure that every service we have is adaptive, and that there are no barriers for somebody getting housing.
And so if somebody has a guide dog, they can stay at a WEAVE shelter. And this model that we're putting together is intended to, you know, be used in, you know, these sorts of partnerships so that domestic violence shelters, sexual assault centers, really do have sort of a, this is how you set yourself up so that you are fully accessible to somebody who's blind and low vision, including, you know, that guide dogs get to come along.
And I want to just add one thing that is critical to this model is that the knowledge is not just held by one person.
Yes.
It's institutionalized. So it's important, as you said, that the person answering the phone to talk to the person who needs shelter understands all the adaptive equipment we have, what our philosophy is in serving people who are blind and low vision, and that it's completely institutionalized throughout every level of our organization.
We're running a little bit short on time. Sarah, I wonder if we should go ahead. I think there's a few more questions. Do we want to go ahead and take a few more, or what do you
think? I think we can take a couple more. I'm sure Linda is okay with that. Linda, are you okay with that if you're up here already?
Linda's not up here, it looks like, yet. So Linda, you raise your hand too, and I'll move you up.
All right. Judy, yeah, let's take a couple of questions.
Judy.
I think I'm unmuted. Yes.
You are.
Finally. Thank you so much for this presentation. Nellie asked you what you're doing to alert shelters. I would like to turn that question around and say, do you know how many shelters there are, and what more could we be doing? And I have a second thing to suggest. I'm going to short circuit this. Do you know about the California Council's Ellen Murphy Fund? where we help blind women over 55, many of whom are the result of situations where they've been abused.
First of all, I don't know about that. I can tell you that there are 104 domestic violence agencies that receive the state funding through Cal OES and have that mandated training that I was talking about, which protects confidential information being shared. So every county has at least one domestic violence shelter. Many counties like LA has a whole bunch of them. So I would love to connect anybody who has an interest in working with their local domestic violence shelter with that resource. There are 62 rape crisis centers. So in some counties, that's a standalone agency. In others, they're like Weave, where they're a combined entity that's serving both. And I know that there is so much need for to make inroads into those organizations. I did a statewide presentation on how to serve persons with disabilities. And, you know, there were 100 people in the room. And I can tell you they are not prepared if somebody comes to them who's blind or low vision.
And I serve on the board of CABVI, which is the California Association of Agencies for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And we've actually done a map to overlay where all the California agencies serving people with vision loss and then the domestic violence agencies, the idea that we can look and see geographically which agencies would match up with the other ones so that as we get further down the road and we have this model that, you know, Beth and I can be the dog and pony show to go out and try to get this going and really activate this resource.
Regina?
Yes, I want to echo the thanks for this presentation. I too am a survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault. And I worked at Society for the Blind where we fielded a lot of calls from people who couldn't get resources. And I'm just so happy that this has happened here in our city and want to be supportive any way we can. I want to also, when you're doing your presentations, there's something that's not well known outside the blindness community, but people can attest to it. One of the things that's being done is sexual encounters are being recorded and then sent audio files around of those encounters without the consent of the person. So the pictures and texting and all that. But among the blind community, what's happening is audio files, and they're being shared nationwide sometimes. And it's very, and it's held over people's head in relationships. It's extremely, it's more widespread than people probably want to talk about. And I just, that's one area. And I just want to encourage us to think of ways that CCB can partner with grants, this grant and grants like them if they come up in the future, so that we be part of the solution for this.
I'm back.
Thank you.
Well, and thank you for that information. I mean, as I said, we've only just started talking about technological abuse as a thing. And, you know, we're constantly adding to that list of tactics that somebody might be using. And that's a very horrible one. So thank you. Thank you for alerting us so that we can be more aware of that.
Yeah. Andrea?
I think I'm unmuted.
Yeah. You are.
Okay. I want to thank you also. This is a wonderful presentation and it's so needed. I was in an abusive marriage for 28 years. I was very lucky because I had the resources and family support to get out and was actually able to keep my home. So I never had to leave. But I need to tell people that this emotional, I was not abused physically until the very end. And the physical abuse at the end was relatively minor. But the psychological and emotional abuse that I suffered, it's very insidious and you don't see it until you're not there. And it's what I grew up with at home. So I thought this was normal. And I realize now that I just repeated what I learned as a child. So it's super, super important to let people know about these kind of things going on. Because I'm sure most of the people who knew my husband and I even casually would say, oh, isn't it wonderful? He takes such good care of her. Well, there was a whole flip side to that. And I'm so grateful. I've been out almost 4 years. I'll be divorced in July. But we served my husband when I was out of town because my attorney wasn't sure what he would do. And she said, the safest thing for you is to go visit family. And I had somewhere to go. I could go see my mom and served him when I was in another state. So people need to realize that it isn't somebody who shows up with black eyes and bruised face. It can be a lot more insidious than that. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. And yes, I want to put a punctuation mark on that. The most dangerous time for a victim is when they're leaving. Right. And people who maybe even not experienced physical abuse end up dead because they underestimated how dangerous that situation could be. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. And I just want to also mention, we have two different initiatives where we're really looking at a two-generational approach to ending domestic violence. You know, we've got a captive audience of non-abusive parents and children in our very large shelter program. We have 125 beds. And it is the perfect time to be working with children to make sure that they understand that a violent home is not a healthy and normal home, and that they can experience a healthy relationship when they grow up.
You have lots of hands, Rob.
I don't know how much longer we're gonna
have to go ahead and okay. Call it quits. I really, really want to thank you ladies for coming and giving us a great presentation. And as Margie said, it's very timely and very important. So thank you very, very much.
Great. And I believe you have our contact information. So, I can't say enough. One, thank you, Beth, for the partnership. And we are so fortunate in the Sacramento region to have such an incredible resource when it's needed. And so it's an honor to partner with Weave and to get to talk to all of you today. And let's continue working together to put an end to this violence.
Absolutely.
All right. So now we're going to move on. And we again appreciate your presentation, Beth and Sherry.
Everybody.